I want you to just close your eyes for a second and imagine a soundscape.
Okay.
The air is heavy. It's like July of 1876. And you can hear this slow, chugging, metallic rumble.
Yeah, that heavy iron sound.
Exactly. The violent hiss of pressurized steam releasing. And then, the rhythmic clacking of iron wheels against iron rails.
Right.
That is the sound of the very first Texas and Pacific steam engine pulling into a dusty half-mile square patch of Texas prairie.
And I mean, for the people standing in the dirt listening to that steam whistle, that sound represented an absolute like world-altering transformation.
Oh,
It was
yeah.
literally the audible arrival of the Industrial Revolution to their front door.
It's wild. But okay, hold that sound in your head. Now, I want you to fast forward exactly 150 years.
Okay.
It's the summer of 2026. You were standing on the exact same geographic coordinates, but the soundscape is, well, it's entirely different.
Completely different.
Yeah, the steam hiss is gone. Instead, you hear a deafening, multilingual, thunderous roar echoing out of a massive space-age structure.
Right,
It's
because
the sound of hundreds of thousands of people from all over the planet converging for the FIFA World Cup.
the contrast there is just phenomenal. I mean, you're looking at a location that goes from a handful of pioneers staring in total awe at a single train to the entire globe descending on that identical spot.
Yeah, navigating a maze of like highways and airports and mega stadiums.
Exactly.
So, welcome to today's deep dive.
Yeah.
We are exploring a really incredible set of source material today.
We really are.
It's the August 2026 digital issue of Arlington Today magazine.
Oh.
It's their 150th anniversary edition, which they're billing as the All-Star issue.
Right.
But our mission today isn't simply to, recount local history from a magazine. We're using this specific text as a lens to examine a much larger, almost universal question about urban evolution.
Yeah, and the tension we're exploring here is that really delicate balancing act.
Between what?
Well, between rapid, massive global expansion and the preservation of a hyper-local, deeply rooted community identity.
Right.
Yeah.
If you live in a city that has experienced any kind of rapid growth or gentrification, you are probably intimately familiar with this struggle.
Because, I mean, the default trajectory for a lot of cities is to court international money, build the massive infrastructure, and in the process, completely pave over their own soul.
Yeah,
The
totally.
people who actually live there end up feeling entirely alienated in their own neighborhoods.
And that's why the source material here is so compelling, because it documents a community actively trying to engineer an alternative outcome.
How so?
While they're attempting to retain the civic DNA of that dusty 1876 railroad stop, while simultaneously managing the logistics of being a, billion-dollar global entertainment powerhouse.
Which is no small feat. And to understand how a city hosts the globe, we kind of have to understand how it first connected to the outside world.
The literal tracks that built the foundation of the city.
Exactly, because the story of that 1876 steam engine doesn't start with a triumphant arrival. It actually starts with a spectacular bureaucratic and economic failure.
Yeah, you're referring to the Texas and Pacific Railway, the TMP.
Right.
The timeline here is really critical. In 1871, the United States Congress charters the TMP Railroad, and the mandate was incredibly ambitious.
They were trying to go all the way to California, right?
Yeah, construct a southern transcontinental route connecting Marshall, Texas, all the way west to San Diego.
Wow.
But the immediate localized goal was to link the growing hubs of Dallas and Fort Worth by 1874.
But the financial realities of the 1870s just slam the brakes on that timeline.
Yeah.
I mean, the panic of 1873 hits,
Right.
railroad bonds collapse, banks fail, and the TNP construction crews hit a geographic and financial wall just west of Dallas at a place called Eagle Ford.
And the tracks just stop.
They just stopped. They sat there for 3 years.
You really have to put yourself in the mindset of the settlers waiting for that train. In the late 19th century, a railroad meant economic survival.
It was everything.
It really was. It was the only viable way to ship cattle, cotton, and goods to larger markets. If the railroad bypassed your settlement, or if it never arrived, your town simply withered and died.
So it was a totally binary outcome.
Exactly. And the TNP was operating under severe pressure, too.
Because of the legislature.
Yeah, the Texas legislature had granted them massive land subsidies to build this route, but those subsidies came with strict deadlines.
Oh, of course.
If the railroad didn't reach Fort Worth by the legislative deadline in mid-1876, the TNP would lose their funding completely.
Which creates this intense psychological pressure cooker for the region. The looming threat of total economic isolation catalyzes an incredible display of collective action.
Right.
The local communities essentially realize that if they don't intervene, the modern world is just going to leave them behind.
And the magazine details the lengths these people went to. We're talking about early 1876 during heavy Texas spring rains.
The mud.
Yeah, the ground is pure, thick clay mud. And you have local citizens, farmers, merchants working alongside the official railroad crews. Wow.
They're digging and laying heavy iron rails deep into the night, operating by the light of kerosene lanterns.
It's a brilliant illustration of human capital being mobilized by an existential threat. The legislature actually granted them two brief extensions, and they barely made the final cutoff.
But they did it.
They successfully forced the connection. But here is the wrinkle in the narrative, though. The tracks were originally surveyed to go through an entirely different settlement.
Right, Johnson Station.
Yeah, Johnson Station was a logical choice. It was an established stagecoach stop. It already had infrastructure, a general store, a post office, a school.
The community was already there.
Exactly. But the surveyors' plans hit two massive roadblocks. First, the geography was prone to heavy flooding, which is, you know, a nightmare for maintaining track integrity.
Yep.
And more importantly, there was a landowner who simply refused to grant the railroad the right-of-way through his property. And we see this constantly in infrastructure history. A single point of friction, one individual exercising their property rights, can completely redirect the flow of capital and geography.
It's crazy to think about.
Yeah, because when you refuse an entity like a transcontinental railroad, they don't typically negotiate for long. They just recalculate.
Right. So the surveyors look at the map and pivot. They move the planned route about 3 miles north of Johnson Station to an area that was essentially just open prairie land.
Completely bypassing the established stagecoach stop.
Yes. Imagine being that landowner. By saying no, he inadvertently signed the death warrant for his own community's economic future and birthed an entirely new city 3 miles north.
It's a massive butterfly effect. And once the new route is established, the railroad has to essentially invent a town to service the stop.
Right.
So they bring in Reverend Andrew S. Hayter. He's a Presbyterian preacher, but crucially, he's also a skilled surveyor.
Handily enough.
Yeah, and he is tasked with platting the settlement.
So he maps out this half-mile square grid. And the railroad is so grateful for his work and so aware that a town needs a recognizable name that they offer to name this new settlement Hayterville, or Hayter.
But he declines.
He turns it down. He suggests they name the town Arlington instead, borrowing the name from Robert E. Lee's estate in Virginia.
That's fascinating.
I find the humility of that act really interesting. He lays the mathematical foundation for the city, but just entirely refuses the glory of the title.
And the immediate aftermath of that grid being laid is a phenomenon we still see in urban planning today, which is the gravity of infrastructure.
What do you mean by gravity?
Well, the moment those stakes went into the ground and the rails were confirmed, the surrounding settlements hollowed out.
Oh, wow.
People physically dismantled their homes and businesses in places like Johnson Station and moved them closer to the new Arlington tracks.
Which culminates in that sensory moment we started with. July 19th, 1876, engine hashtag 20 arrives. The source text paints such a vivid picture of this day. People traveling for miles by wagon, dressed in their absolute finest clothes, bringing picnic baskets.
It was a huge event.
And the train itself was a spectacle, painted black, gold striping, polished brass, a bright red cattle guard.
You're really describing the arrival of a technology that shrinks time and space?
Definitely.
I mean, prior to that afternoon, a journey to Dallas or Fort Worth might take a full day of hard travel by horse. After that afternoon, it took less than an hour.
That's a paradigm shift.
Exactly. The local depot instantly became the nucleus of the community.
And the magazine traces the history of the city's depots, and it's a great microcosm of civic evolution. The first depot in 1877 was a simple wooden structure that actually caught fire and burned.
Oh, tragic.
Yeah. The second, built in 1904, was a much more substantial brick building with this distinct tower, and it operated until 1956.
Right.
But there's a specific historical footnote about that middle depot that I think perfectly bridges the gap between the town's pioneer roots and its future as a global destination.
You're talking about the post-World War II relief effort.
Yes. In the early 1950s, this local Texas train station transforms into a logistical staging ground.
Right.
The town adopts Bad Königshofen, Germany, as a sister city. They are literally using this local depot to pack and ship massive amounts of food, clothing, and care packages across the Atlantic to help this German town rebuild after the war.
And when you analyze the sociology of mid-century American towns, the stereotype is often one of deep isolationism.
Sure, very inward-looking.
But here you have a relatively small municipality actively organizing a complex international supply chain.
It's amazing.
They're utilizing the very same iron rails that brought them into the modern world to extend their civic reach globally.
It proves the city was developing an international reflex long before it was economically necessary.
Exactly. The psychological infrastructure for global connection was already in place. The physical rails of the 19th century were just the first iteration of a much larger network.
And that network evolution is just staggering. Let's look at the modern equivalent of that steam engine arrival.
Okay, let's do it.
Exactly 150 years after a few hundred people gathered to watch a train, the entire globe arrived via intercontinental flights and multi-lane highways. In the summer of 2026, this city hosted the FIFA World Cup.
And managing a World Cup is an urban planning crucible. You're taking a city with a baseline population of roughly 400,000 residents and subjecting its infrastructure to a sustained month-long shockwave of international tourism.
It's like hosting a Super Bowl every single weekend for a month.
Pretty much.
And the economic data in the magazine from the local Convention and Visitors Bureau, the CVB, is just wild.
Yeah.
And just to clarify for anyone unfamiliar, CVD is essentially the marketing and tourism engine for municipality. Their sole job is to attract conventions, sports events, and tourists to generate tax revenue.
And they clearly succeed here.
Big time. In June of 2026, hotel room revenue shattered the previous record by a staggering 25%.
We really need to contextualize what a 25% spike in hotel revenue actually means for a municipality.
Okay, yeah, break that down.
Because that is not just profit for hotel owners. That translates directly into a massive influx of hotel occupancy tax, or HOT funds.
Right.
That is capital generated entirely by people who do not live in the city, which the city can then legally mandate toward maintaining its parks, arts programs, and public safety infrastructure.
So it's basically free money for the locals.
Exactly. It's a brilliant mechanism for subsidizing local quality of life using outside capital.
But the economic mechanics are almost overshadowed by the sheer cultural logistics described in the magazine. There is a specific story about the Dutch national team's fan base, known as the Orange Army.
Oh, this is a great story.
We're talking about 15,000 people from the Netherlands.
15,000 fans, all wearing bright orange, operating as a single, cohesive unit within a Texas city.
The logistics of that are mind-bending, because they don't just, like, take a fleet of buses to AT&T Stadium. They organize a massive fan march through the city streets.
Right.
Imagine the coordination required between public safety officials, traffic engineering, and transit authorities to safely route 15,000 singing, dancing pedestrians through a modern entertainment district without completely paralyzing the entire city grid.
And during this meticulously planned march, an unscripted moment occurs that speaks directly to the sociological power of these mega events.
Yeah, the Dutch fans encounter the Japanese fans.
Right.
Their opposing team for the match.
Right.
I mean, in almost any other context, two massive groups of opposing sports fans colliding in the street requires riot police.
Oh, for sure. Sports hooliganism is a highly documented phenomenon. The tribalism usually dictates hostility.
But instead, the Orange Army invites the Japanese fans into the march. They just absorb them. You have this massive multinational block of humanity singing and dancing together toward the stadium.
And the president of the CVB makes a really critical point in the magazine about moments like this.
What's that?
He argues that the true return on investment for hosting the World Cup is not the 25% hotel tax bump. It is the ability to leverage soft power.
Soft power meaning changing the global perception of the city and the country.
Precisely. Consider the mindset of an international traveler. Navigating a foreign country during a massive, crowded event is inherently stressful.
Very stressful.
If the logistics fail, if the transit system collapses, if the police are overly aggressive, if the locals are hostile, that negative experience becomes their defining narrative of the United States.
Yeah, they go home and tell their friends not to visit.
Exactly. But if the civic infrastructure holds up and the environment fosters spontaneous moments of cross-cultural joy, you alter international travel patterns for decades. You build immense global goodwill.
And the city clearly understands the value of that goodwill.
Yeah.
And they're actively trying to anchor it into the physical landscape. The magazine highlights two permanent pieces of infrastructure left behind by the World Cup. First, this massive Texan Golden Boot sculpture, which serves as a permanent tourist magnet and photo opportunity.
Like a landmark.
Yeah. But the second one is much more functional. A new mini pitch at George Stevens Park.
And for listeners who might not follow urban sports development, a mini pitch is essentially a small, hard surface soccer court, often enclosed with rebound walls.
Why build a mini pitch instead of, you know, a full grass field?
Because it is a highly efficient use of urban space. Full grass fields require immense water, maintenance, and acreage. A mini pitch can transform an underutilized paved lot into a high-intensity recreation zone.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. By placing this in a local park, the city is taking the momentum of a global event and converting it into a tangible daily asset for the kids in that specific neighborhood.
It's a really smart way to ensure the legacy outlasts the tournament. And looking at the broader tourism data, the city's economic engine is just operating at an incredibly high RPM.
It really is.
The magazine provides the final tourism numbers for 2025, so the year before the World Cup. 16.5 million visitors.
Which is, I mean, that is essentially the entire population of the Netherlands traveling to this single city in a 12-month period.
It's staggering. They break that number down into 9.2 million overnight visits and 7.4 million day trips, generating $3.3 billion in economic impact.
Wow.
And what is genuinely impressive about those numbers is the macroeconomic context. Because 2025 was not an easy year for travel.
No, not at all.
There were significant economic headwinds, inflation, high fuel costs, fluctuating airline prices, yet the city outperformed its 2024 metrics across the board.
So how do you explain that resilience? I mean, when the broader economy tightens, discretionary travel is usually the first thing families cut.
I look at the density of their infrastructure. When you cluster AT&T Stadium, Globe Life Field, multiple massive theme parks, and enormous convention spaces within a localized district, you create an economic gravity well.
Right. They all feed off each other.
Exactly. You aren't relying on a single attraction to draw people. You're offering a critical mass of entertainment that makes the travel cost feel justified to the consumer.
That density is key. And maintaining that gravity requires really aggressive, forward-looking strategy. You don't just passively wait for conventions to book your city.
Which the magazine illustrates perfectly. They mention an upcoming event, the International Association of Firefighters Convention.
That's a huge one.
Massive influx of professionals. And the article notes that to secure this bid, the mayor and a team of city officials physically flew to Canada back in 2022 to pitch the organization.
Right. So they're operating on a four-year acquisition cycle. That level of long-term strategic planning is the only way you feed an infrastructure engine of this magnitude.
But this brings us to a really critical transition point in the deep dive. We've established the foundation, the rails. We've examined the massive economic engine, the global tourism, and the billions of dollars flowing in.
Yeah.
But a booming billion-dollar economy is essentially useless to the local population if the city doesn't intentionally prepare its own citizens to operate and inherit that hub.
And this is the fatal flaw in many rapidly expanding cities.
How so?
Well, they build the infrastructure, they generate the wealth, but they fail to develop their own human capital. The high-paying jobs in technology, management, and medicine end up going to people imported from out of state, while the local youth are relegated to low-tier service jobs.
And the community just hollows out.
Exactly.
To combat that, you really have to look at the education system. The magazine features a massive deep dive into the Arlington Independent School District, the ASD, and their educational philosophy.
Yeah.
And they're actively dismantling the traditional educational model.
Because the traditional public school system, often based on the Horace Mann industrialized model, was designed over a century ago. The objective was to produce a compliant, standardized workforce for factory labor. Everyone sits in a grid, consumes the exact same curriculum at the exact same pace, and moves forward based on age rather than aptitude or interest.
A completely uniform assembly line.
But a globalized, hyper-competitive economy doesn't need uniform factory workers. It needs highly specialized, adaptable problem solvers.
Right.
And the ASD's shift toward what they call signature programs is a direct response to this economic reality.
They're introducing specialization incredibly early. The magazine lists several specific academies. You have the Corey and Jones Academies, which integrate fine arts and dual language immersion into the daily curriculum.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, and then you have the Piercy and Martin Academies, which are deeply focused on STEM science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Okay.
But the concept that really stood out to me was their implementation of P-TECH early college high schools.
PTEC is a really fascinating educational framework. It stands for Pathways in Technology Early College High School.
How does that actually work mechanically? Like, how is it different from just a student taking an AP class?
It's a complete structural overhaul. In a traditional high school, you graduate with a diploma and then figure out your next steps.
Right.
But a PTEC model integrates high school, college, and the professional world into a single, seamless pathway. The school partners directly with local community colleges and, crucially, specific corporate industry partners.
So the corporations are actually helping design the curriculum.
Yes, to ensure the students are learning the exact skills the modern workforce currently requires.
Wow.
Students in a PTEC program don't just graduate with a high school diploma. They graduate with a tuition-free associate degree in a specialized, high-demand technical field.
That's huge.
And they're generally first in line for job interviews with those corporate partners. It perfectly bridges the gap between public education and the local economic engine.
You're essentially handing a teenager a tangible, highly marketable asset before they even turn 18. But I do want to bring up a point of friction here. Because alongside these physical academies, the magazine proudly announces the launch of Arlington ISD Online Learning.
Okay.
They're offering flexible virtual courses for juniors and seniors and an entire virtual early college for incoming freshmen.
You seem a little hesitant about the virtual component.
I am. And I think a lot of listeners will share this hesitation. Yeah.
Sure.
We all experienced the emergency pivot to virtual learning in the early 2020s. For a vast majority of students, it was incredibly detrimental.
It's tough.
The lack of socialization, the screen fatigue, the difficulty of maintaining focus. So my question is this new virtual push genuinely a pedagogical advancement? Or is this just a school district trying to justify software they bought during a pandemic by rebranding it as the future?
That is a highly relevant debate. And honestly, it's actively happening in school board meetings across the country right now.
I bet.
The instinct to reject virtual learning based on the emergency remote learning of the past is entirely natural. However, the data and the framework presented by the A's suggest a much more sophisticated approach.
Okay, so break that down for me. How is a virtual early college different from a teenager just staring at a Zoom screen all day?
Emergency remote learning was synchronous, meaning they were trying to replicate a rigid bell schedule over a video call. It failed because it ignored the medium.
Right.
The AISED approach appears to be asynchronous and mastery-based. The magazine specifically notes that education in the district isn't bound by four walls and a bell schedule anymore.
So they're just eliminating the bell schedule entirely.
For the students who choose this pathway, yes. You have to recognize that for a specific subset of the student population, the traditional school environment is an active barrier to success.
Give me an example of who this actually helps.
Well, consider a student who is an elite pre-Olympic athlete whose training schedule requires them to be at a facility from 8 a.m. to noon.
Okay, fair.
Or consider a student whose family faces severe economic hardship, requiring the student to work a full-time job during standard school hours just to help pay rent.
Wow, yeah.
Or even consider a student with severe social anxiety who academically thrives but emotionally collapses in a crowded hallway. For those students, forcing them into a rigid 8-to-3 physical box basically guarantees they will underperform or drop out.
Okay, I see the logic. So it's not about forcing the general population into a virtual model. It's about providing a highly structured, rigorous alternative for the specific demographics that require flexibility.
Precisely. It's just another signature pathway. It empowers the student to dictate the pace and environment of their learning rather than forcing them to conform to an industrial era timeline.
And they are also aggressively connecting students to the physical economy outside the classroom walls. There is a program highlighted in the magazine called the 40 Futures Initiative.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Five local students are currently receiving paid internships, direct mentorship, and professional development training.
And look at the specific sectors those internships are in.
Hospitality, tourism, and sports.
Exactly. This is the ultimate synthesis of everything we've discussed today. The city has built a multi-billion-dollar tourism and sports infrastructure.
Right.
Instead of letting that infrastructure exist as an isolated island of wealth, the 40 Futures Initiative acts as a pipeline. It takes local students and places them directly inside the machine.
That's brilliant.
It teaches them the operational mechanics of the hotel industry, the logistics of event management, the business of sports.
They're actively training the next generation of leadership to run the city's primary economic engine, keeping the human capital local.
It is the ultimate defense against the hollowing out of a community.
Which leads us perfectly into the daily reality of the city. We've talked about the historical foundation, the macroeconomic engine, and the educational pipeline.
Right.
But the ultimate test of urban evolution is daily quality of life. What makes this a place people actually want to reside in on a random Tuesday when there isn't a World Cup match?
Because a strong tax base is completely meaningless if the residents don't have access to high-tier health care, robust daily culture, and a real sense of community connection.
So let's start with the healthcare piece, because the magazine dedicates significant space to medical innovation, specifically the Baylor Scott and White Orthopedic and Spine Hospital.
Yeah.
The technology they're deploying locally sounds incredibly advanced.
Historically, if a patient required highly complex robotic-assisted orthopedic surgery, they had to travel to a massive medical research center in a primary metropolis, a place like the Texas Medical Center in Houston, or the Mayo Clinic.
Right.
The fact that this level of tech is available at a local community hospital is a major indicator of civic health.
And they list the specific robotic suites they use. They have the Mako robotic arm-assisted system for joint replacements.
Yeah.
They have the ROSC robotic system for knee procedures. And they just introduced the TMINI handheld robotic system. Help us understand the actual mechanics here.
Oh.
Why is a robotic system vastly superior to a highly skilled, experienced human surgeon operating with traditional tools?
To really understand the advantage, you have to understand how traditional joint replacement works. A human surgeon uses two-dimensional x-rays to plan the surgery.
Okay.
During the procedure, they use physical cutting blocks and jigs to align their bone saws. But no matter how skilled the surgeon is, there's always an inherent margin of error.
Because they're human.
Right. The human hand has microscopic tremors, and a 2D image just doesn't perfectly represent 3D anatomy.
So how does the Mako or RSA system change that mechanical process?
The robotic systems utilize advanced CT scans to generate a perfect, high-resolution 3D model of the patient's specific joint before the surgery even begins.
Oh, wow.
And the surgeon uses that 3D model to meticulously plan the exact angles and depths of every single cut.
I try to think of this in terms of navigation. Like, if a traditional surgery is like driving to a new destination using a printed paper map, you know, generally where you're going, but you might drift slightly out of your lane, is the robotic system like a self-driving car?
That is a very apt analogy. The robotic arm doesn't perform the surgery on its own. It operates more like lane assist technology.
Okay.
The surgeon physically guides the robotic arm, but the system establishes a virtual boundary, like a haptic feedback zone. If the surgeon's blade approaches healthy bone or critical soft tissue outside the pre-planned 3D area, the robotic arm literally resists the movement and shuts off the saw.
Whoa. It mathematically prevents the surgeon from making an error.
Exactly. It ensures millimeter-level precision. And this means less soft tissue trauma, optimal alignment of the artificial implant, and ultimately a significantly faster and less painful recovery for the patient.
And from an economic standpoint, having this technology locally creates a incredibly powerful retention cycle. If you are a resident facing a knee replacement and you know the local hospital has the Mako system, you don't travel to Houston.
No, you stay in your community. Your insurance payouts and personal healthcare expenditures remain within the local economy.
And on the flip side, if you're a top-tier, ambitious orthopedic surgeon coming out of residency, you want to work at a facility that provides you with the most advanced tools available.
Absolutely.
By investing in robotics, the local hospital attracts and retains elite medical talent, which further elevates the standard of care for the entire population. It's a brilliant self-sustaining loop.
It really is the healthcare equivalent of building the mega stadiums. You build the infrastructure to keep the capital from leaving.
Speaking of stadiums, we have to talk about the cultural zoning of this city. The itinerary in the magazine is a wild study in contrasts.
It's pretty amazing.
In August of 2026, within the massive footprint of AT&T Stadium, you have two globally dominant musical acts performing. First, the BTS Erang World Tour.
Wow.
You are talking about the absolute zenith of global K-pop, drawing fans from multiple continents. And then a few days later, Zach Bryan takes the exact same stage, bringing a massive stadium country spectacle.
And these are events that require massive logistical footprints, parking, security, crowd control.
But what is incredible is what is happening simultaneously just down the street. While the global stadium tours are raging, the Arlington Music Hall, a historic local venue, is hosting deeply rooted heritage acts.
Right.
On the very same weekend as BTS, you can go see Bob Wills Texas Playboys under the direction of Jason Roberts playing classic Western swing music.
That's a contrast right there.
And later in the month, the Bellamy Brothers are playing their 50th anniversary show.
The ability for a city to simultaneously host a K-pop phenomenon and a 50-year-old classic country heritage act without one culturally cannibalizing the other speaks volumes about its urban planning and zoning.
How so? Like, what does that actually look like in practice?
Well, in many cities, when massive entertainment districts are built, the sheer economic weight of the new developments crushes the historic venues.
Yeah, because of property values.
Exactly. Rent skyrockets, parking becomes impossible for locals, and the heritage culture is pushed out to the distant suburbs.
Right.
The fact that the Arlington Music Hall is thriving right alongside AT&T Stadium suggests the city has intentionally designed distinct cultural corridors that protect local venues while still accommodating global spectacles.
They're actively managing the scale. And you see that intentional community scaling in other ways, too. The magazine highlights an organization called the Taste Project, specifically their Supper Club initiative.
This is the perfect counterweight to a 100,000-seat stadium.
It truly is. The Taste Project operates a community restaurant model. They're hosting a chef-curated fall menu. You buy a ticket in advance. It's a BYOB setup, and the entire purpose of the evening is intimate, localized connection.
It serves a fundamentally different psychological need. A stadium concert is an exercise in collective effervescence. You want to feel the energy of being an anonymous part of a massive roaring crowd.
Which is fun.
It is. But humans cannot sustain themselves on spectacle alone. A community supper club provides the vital counter experience. Sitting across a table, making eye contact, and conversing with your actual neighbors.
Yeah.
Both scales of experience are absolutely essential for a city to feel habitable and alive.
You need the global roar, but you also need the local conversation. And sometimes, you just need a piece of living history. I honestly cannot leave out my absolute favorite quirky detail from the All-Star issue.
Let's hear it.
Amidst the robotic surgery, the global soccer tournaments, and the high-tech educational pathways, the magazine celebrates the 60th birthday of a roller coaster.
The runaway mine train.
The runaway mine train at Six Flags Over Texas. Since July of 1966, this wooden and steel coaster has been operating. People are still climbing that 60-foot lift hill to take a 39-foot drop.
Mm-hmm.
I just love that detail because it perfectly encapsulates the city's identity.
It really is the physical embodiment of the overarching theme we discussed at the very beginning.
Right. You have a city where you can receive millimeter-precise robotic joint replacements in the morning, attend a massive, cutting-edge global stadium tour in the evening, and in the middle of the afternoon, you can strap into a 60-year-old mine train ride.
Yeah.
The city isn't erasing its past to make room for its future. It's stacking them on top of each other.
Which brings our analysis of this source material to its logical conclusion. When you look at the trajectory from the 1876 TNP Railroad to the 2026 FIFA World Cup, the scale of the city has expanded exponentially. But the underlying formula for its survival has remained remarkably consistent.
Build the infrastructure to connect with the outside world, but aggressively defend the local DNA.
The pioneers laying iron rails in the mud by lantern light in 1876 were driven by the exact same civic instinct as the CVB executives negotiating international conventions today or the school board designing virtual education pathways.
It's the same impulse.
Yes. They are all actively constructing conduits to the future to ensure their community doesn't get left behind.
Well, we are coming to the end of our hour together. As always, based on everything we've extracted from this 150th anniversary magazine, what is the final provocative thought you want to leave the listener with today?
We have spent a significant amount of time today discussing tracks.
Right.
The literal iron rails of the Texas and Pacific defined the city's first century. They dictated where the city was built, they brought the people, and they facilitated the commerce. Today, those physical rails have been largely superseded by the massive infrastructure of global tourism. The highways, the airports, the mega stadiums.
Yeah.
That physical infrastructure is what defines the city right now.
The new iron tracks.
Exactly. But if we are projecting forward to the future, I want you, the listener, to consider this. What are the invisible tracks being laid down right now?
The invisible tracks.
Think about it. We discussed the virtual classrooms, the specialized STEM academies, the 40 Futures hospitality internships, the local investments in medical robotics, and the community supper clubs. These are not structures made of steel or concrete.
Yeah.
They are networks of human capital, intellectual property, and civic bonds.
So, what are the unseen connections and educational pathways being engineered today that will dictate the economic and cultural geography of this city when they publish the 300th anniversary issue in 2176?
It makes you look at a high school curriculum or a community dinner as a piece of infrastructure just as vital as a railroad or a stadium.
Because it is. The infrastructure of tomorrow is human.
That is a phenomenal place to wrap up.
We want to thank you, the listener, for spending this hour with us on The Deep Dive. The next time you're walking through your own downtown or sitting in local traffic or attending a city council meeting, look past the physical buildings and ask yourself, what invisible tracks are being laid right beneath your feet and where are they taking your community? We will catch you next time.